We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives. But can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now, welcome your host, Jen Lumenlund.
Hello, and welcome to the Your Parenting Mojo podcast. Before we get started today, I'd like to take a few minutes to chat with you about the podcast. Firstly, I'd like to thank you so much for listening to the show. I've been really honored over the last few weeks since I started it to hear from so many of you about how much the show is helping you in your parenting. Because at the end of the day, I'm getting a master's degree in psychology focusing on child development to be a better parent myself and to help you be better parents as well. There's just too much good information out there about how this whole parenting thing works for us to bumble along and not know any better. And I put myself in the same boat as you here. I'm literally figuring this stuff out with you as I go. I don't always handle things in the best way with my daughter, but when I learn better, I do better, and I forgive myself for having done things the old way. I'm growing as a parent because of what I'm learning with you, and I'm honored that those of you who have left me reviews on iTunes and have written to me and told me how much the show is helping you are finding it useful too. So I have four specific favors to ask of you. It sounds like a lot, and each one will take you from a couple of seconds to around about a couple of minutes. But if you get some value out of the show, then please keep in mind it takes me 10 to 15 hours to research, write, and record each episode. So you can consider these four favors as a kind of Chinese menu and only do the ones you want. But you know how you always order too much food in a Chinese restaurant? Well, maybe you should consider doing that here as well. Just a suggestion. So firstly, if you enjoy this episode, and especially if you've enjoyed several episodes, please subscribe to the show so you don't miss an episode. Because I'm learning in the same way that you are, we often build one episode on top of another. And I regularly refer back to the episode on scaffolding, for example, and if you've already listened to that one, then you'll be able to follow right along as I describe how to scaffold behavior in a certain situation, for example, in the episode related to tantrums. So you can subscribe on iTunes, or if you go to yourparentingmojo.com, you can actually get a little freebie for signing up. It's a list of 7 relationship-based strategies that I use to support my daughter's development, and it also helps to make parenting just a bit easier on me. And secondly, while you're over on iTunes, I'd love it if you'd leave a rating and a review of the show. It doesn't have to be super long, just decide how many stars you think it's worth. 5 is always a good number. And jot down a couple of lines about what you think about the show. Shows that have more ratings and reviews appear higher in the iTunes listings, which will encourage more people to listen. Thirdly, if you know of any other parents who could benefit from learning about what we're learning, please let them know about the show. You can send them a link in an email or put it up on your Facebook or Twitter feed. If you're on Twitter, you can find me at A Kid Is For Life. And finally, I really do love hearing from listeners, especially if you have an idea for a topic for the show. If you do, then please drop me a line at jen@yourparentingmojo.com. And if there's enough scientific research available on that topic, then I'll do an episode just for you. And you can also drop me a line if you have any other feedback or even if you'd just like to chat. All right, on to today's topic, which is called How to Support Your Introverted or Shy Toddler. This episode is very personal to me. I have a triple whammy of personality characteristics that are socially undesirable in the US, at least. I'm an introvert, I'm shy, and I'm also a very highly sensitive person, and I actually never even knew that last one was a thing until a few weeks ago. Since my daughter's only 2 and she's at the stage where children tend to play alongside each other rather than with each other, it can be a bit difficult to tell which personality traits are really hers and which are just a function of her current stage of development. But I'm starting to see some signs of introversion and shyness, so I wanted to get a handle on the research, not so much so I can diagnose her, but more to know what to watch for and how I can support her, because American culture is very much geared towards the success of extroverts. Somewhere between a third and a half of the population in this country may be introverted, so if you have 2 or 3 children, then chances are one of them is introverted. So listen on to hear more about how introversion and shyness are not the same thing, and what the research says about how we can support our introverted and shy children. I got the idea for this episode after I read the book Quiet by Susan Cain. I've known I'm an introvert for a very long time. I took classes in psychology after finishing high school in England, and we took Eysenck's personality inventory. There's a link to a free version online that you can take yourself and the references for this episode. And I was basically off the charts introverted. So I'd heard of the book Quiet when it was published in 2012, but I didn't really pay it much attention because I figured I didn't need to be diagnosed. I already knew I was introverted. But someone recommended to me as an example of a book that makes scientific research really accessible to a non-scientific audience. And so I read it from that perspective, and I ended up learning a lot about myself in the process. The first point that I want to make is a very important one, and that is that introversion and shyness are not the same thing. And because it's so important and kind of non-intuitive, I'm going to say it again, introversion and shyness are not the same thing. It actually took me a little while to get my head around that. The basic meaning of an introvert is that it's a person who gets their energy from being in environments that provide low levels of stimulation, which often means being alone rather than being with other people. Whereas extroverts find being in environments with high levels of stimulation, like when there are a lot of other people around, very energizing. Introverts might have good social skills and can participate in parties and events, but after a while they wish they were tucked up at home on the sofa with a cup of tea and a good book. Susan Cain lists characteristics of introverts in the book, and some of these are that they prefer to devote their social energies to close friends and colleagues and family. They listen more than they talk. They think before they speak, and they often feel as if they express themselves better in writing than in conversation. They tend to dislike conflict. Many of them have a horror of small talk, but enjoy deep discussions. And the part of this that caught my attention was that I hadn't realized how much my introversion affected parts of how I deal with the world that aren't directly related to going to parties. While I often have 5 or 6 books on the go at once, virtually all of them child development books these days, I do really prefer to dig deeply into one of them. And I work in consulting, where it's really common for someone to call a meeting and show you some PowerPoint slides and get you to react to it immediately, whereas I would really prefer them to send me the deck in advance so I can take notes and have some time to process before I give my thoughts. So what's the difference between introversion and shyness? The book Quiet says that while introversion is a preference for environments that aren't overstimulating, shyness is a fear of social disapproval or humiliation. Shyness is inherently painful, while introversion is not. A lot of people get them confused because they overlap to some extent. I'd always thought that my shyness is part of my introversion. But it's possible to be a shy extrovert, like Barbra Streisand, who has massive stage presence and an apparently awful stage fright, or a non-shy introvert, like Bill Gates, who prefers his own company, but isn't afraid of the disapproval or humiliation of others that's the hallmark of shyness. And a key point is that while shyness and introversion are very different to the person experiencing them, to the outside world, they look much the same. A shy person may be afraid to talk to other people at a party, while an introvert might just be overstimulated. But the other people at the party can't tell which it is, and all they see is someone who isn't interested in talking, and thus must not be very interesting themselves either. Or maybe they're just stuck up, or both. What makes shyness painful and problematic is that it can get in the way of achieving things we want to do. I might wish I could go to a networking event to advance my career, but maybe I'm too afraid of what people there would think about me. In that case, my shyness is getting in the way of something I want to achieve, especially if I'm looking for a new job. I was actually surprised that there's a decent amount of research available on introversion and shyness, and quite a bit of it is longitudinal, which is even more surprising. It's pretty unusual for researchers to follow children for any length of time because it makes a study so expensive. It seems as though most of the research on both introversion and shyness in children eventually comes back to the work of two doctors named Alexander Thomas and Stella Chess, who worked out of the New York University Medical Center from the 1950s through the 1970s. Their study is considered to be a classic assessment of the idea of temperament, which underlies many other personality traits like introversion and shyness. We have to take their results with a bit of a grain of salt because while 141 children is quite a lot for one study, it isn't much compared to the population of children in the world or a country or even New York. And these children were drawn from 85 families, 78% of which were Jewish, the rest Protestant or Catholic, with 60% of the fathers and 40% of the mothers having both college and postgraduate degrees. The researchers don't say why their population was so homogenous, but they did attempt to validate the findings using a sample of 85 low-income children in Puerto Rico some years later. So Thomas and Chess identified 9 dimensions of temperament, which they grouped into 3 major categories. Easy children were characterized by having regular bodily functions like sleeping and bowel movements. They were adaptable, usually in a positive mood, and would approach rather than withdraw in a new situation. The difficult child was described as having irregular bodily functions, not being very adaptable, withdrawing rather than approaching in new situations, intense, and often irritable or fussy. The third category was the slow to warm up child, who seemed much like an easy child except that he would initially withdraw in response to a new situation, and would be slow to adapt, but would come around eventually. About 35% of the children didn't fit into one of those 3 patterns. Of the remaining 65%, 40% were classified as easy, 10% were difficult, and 15% were slow to warm up. The famous psychologist Jerome Kagan moves this research one step further by doing some tests on 500 white infants, although he doesn't say what religion they were, at age 4 months, 2 years, 4 years, 7 years, and 11 years of age, with the sample size dropping down to 237 children by the time they were 11 years old. The central thesis of the study was that in the test at 4 months, children who kicked their arms and legs around or cried when they were presented with unusual things to look at, hear, and smell did this because they'd inherited a trait that made a certain part of their brains very excitable. About 20% of the children did pump their arms and legs and cried, and these children were called high reactive. 40% of the children showed the opposite pattern, minimal arm and leg movements and no crying. These were called low reactive. 25% didn't move around but did cry a lot and were called distressed. And 10% moved around a lot but didn't cry, and those children were called aroused. The remaining 5% of children were difficult to classify. The theory goes that children whose brains quickly become highly stimulated, which is indicated when they move around and cry, will seek out situations where they don't get too much stimulation. In other words, they'll become introverts. And the children whose brains need more stimulation before they get to an optimal level of arousal become extroverts, because they need more stimulation, both social and non-social, to get to that optimal level. Now, I should note that Jerome Kagan is interested in the biological basis of temperament, and even he acknowledges that your genetic predisposition to prefer or avoid stimulus is not your destiny. About 33% of the high and low reactive children displayed the pattern of behavior they were supposed to, as predicted by their infant temperament, when they were interviewed at age 11, while 16% behaved in ways that were inconsistent with expectations, a ratio of 2-1, but much less than 100%. The researchers noticed that the infants who had been high reactive were mostly serious and didn't smile during any one of the assessments from 4 months through 11 years. More low reactives smiled and laughed frequently at every age. Many low reactives, but few high reactives, smiled and laughed within the first minute of entering the lab at 11 years of age. And smiling at 11 years was predicted by smiling at 2 years. So if not all of the high reactive children became introverts, what's going on? It's called the moderating effect of the environment. And a lot of that is the moderating effect of parents. So how do these parents support introverted and shy children? Regarding introversion, it's really a matter of setting up your child's life so he gets the right amount of stimulation, both social and otherwise, that he needs. There's evidence that many introverts are also highly sensitive people, people who notice and perceive things more strongly than others do. There are quizzes you can do to test this in yourself and in your child as well. There's a link to one in the references. I had no idea I was a highly sensitive person until just a few weeks ago when my husband handed me one of those checklist articles from BuzzFeed or somewhere like that that described the characteristics. I usually hate those things, so I tried to make him take his phone back, but he insisted I read it, and I was shocked to find that it basically describes me. I cut the tags out of my clothes because I can't stand them itching me. I always want him to turn the TV down. I regularly notice continuity errors in films. And I notice manners. Now, not all introverts are also highly sensitive. But when we talk about supporting an introvert, we should also consider the possibility that she experiences things more acutely than you might as a parent. And thus, if you think you've ratcheted down the stimulation enough, then consider the possibility that it's still too much for her. I think my 2-year-old may be an introvert because a lot of the time she seems to prefer staying home to going out or doing her other activities. Sometimes when we have music on, she asks me to turn it down because she thinks it's too loud, even though I don't think it's that loud and I'm highly sensitive. So when I put on music, I make sure not to put it on too loud. And we don't keep a busy schedule here. She goes to daycare while I'm at work, but on the weekends, we do a lot of relaxing around the house. We don't rush from one class to the next. A busy day for us would be to go to another child's birthday party and go grocery shopping on the same day. I get my need for alone time in the weeks I work from home, while my husband gets his need for socialization by going to the office most days. I do wonder whether my daughter's getting her need for alone time met during her time at daycare. The school does have a quiet nook where a child could pull curtains around herself and be alone for a bit, but I'm guessing that the structure of the school day means that most of the time the children are engaged with some activity. It's something I plan to discuss with her teachers in the future. I have to say that while the majority of the book Quiet was exhaustively referenced, the chapter on how to support an introverted child really wasn't. The references page for that chapter are based on interviews with teachers, school administrators, child psychologists, and a list of 7 books. 3 of which have the word shy in the title, which I thought was pretty surprising given that the author spends a good chunk of the book telling us how introversion and shyness are not the same thing. I was disappointed to find that 2 of those books specifically on shyness contain no references at all, which is how I evaluate the quality of a book. I don't want to just trust the author's word. I want to know she's basing her recommendations in research. The third of these books that I got was Jerome Kagan's book on temperament, which, once it starts to talk about environmental influences on temperament, begins to mix in mentions of shyness with what seem to be descriptions of stimulus-avoiding introverts. So my exploration of how to support shy children is unfortunately necessarily linked to the research on shyness and temperament and introversion, because it's very difficult to separate them out in the research. Psychologists Barbara and Gregory Markway point out that, as with many personality traits, including introversion and extroversion, we can think of shyness on a scale. On the left side is someone who is shy but basically secure and successful. She gets through situations like giving a presentation if she has to. She attends parties of her peers she knows well. She might say she's stressed out when she transitions to a new school, but she's able to adapt, and in a month or two, she's basically doing fine. You can see how this connects up to Thomas and Chess's description of the slow-to-warm-up child. Moving over slightly to the right, and we see the child who is shy and has some problems because of it. Maybe she wishes she could be more outgoing but doesn't know how. And next, further over to the right, is the specific social anxiety disorder, which produces a paralyzing anxiety in a highly stressful social situation like giving a performance. Then there's what's called mild to moderate generalized social anxiety disorder, where the child shows physical symptoms of anxiety like headaches, stomach aches, and panic attacks. And finally, all the way over on the right of the continuum is severe generalized social anxiety disorder, which includes children who have selective mutism, where they refuse to or physically cannot speak in certain situations, refuse to go to school, or become depressed. I think my daughter falls at the far left end of the continuum. She's definitely slow to warm up to new people and didn't like her new daycare much for the first week or so, but she seems to have settled in okay. She sometimes plays peekaboo with the other children, but just as often she likes to sit on a rock in the playground that she seems to have picked out because it has a commanding view of the whole area, from which she'll observe the other children, occasionally running over to see what a small group is doing before returning to her perch. One thing that I left out of the behavior descriptions of shyness that I mentioned a minute ago, for the sake of making it easier to follow, was the extent to which the interactions with parents impact where the child fall. The parents of the shy but basically successful child are described as accepting her shy temperament and have never really made a big deal out of it. They encourage her to break out of her comfort zone and try new things, but they're not overly pushy. The shy but showing some problems child has parents who like to throw parties and become upset when the child doesn't come out of her room and talk with their guests. The child with mild to moderate generalized social anxiety disorder has a family who moves around a lot, making it hard to make friends. Now, the last thing I want to do here is make anyone feel responsible or guilty for any trait in their child that they perceive as negative. I'm certainly not trying to say that if your child has a diagnosable anxiety disorder that you gave it to them, either genetically or in the environment that you provided. If your child already falls over on that right side of the scale, then now might be a good time to consider finding some professional help to get the child to master social anxiety, which is really beyond the scope of this podcast. What I want to spend the rest of the time thinking through today for myself as well as you is the idea that if your child is over on the left end of the social anxiety continuum right now, whether it's a result of genetics or the kinds of environment that you've raised them in until now, then there are things that you can do to try and make sure they don't keep moving to the right of the continuum, and maybe push them back to the left a little bit. I don't want to say that all shyness can or should be cured, because some people find it quite adaptive. Perhaps a researcher gives a better presentation in front of an audience because she's shy and doesn't want to fail, so she puts in the extra time and effort to prepare. But to the extent that shyness and even introversion hamper your child's ability to live her life, I believe it's worth doing what we can to support her in managing them. I've culled some ideas from a review of quite a number of books and research papers, and I'll go through the 7 overarching ideas that seem worthy of putting into practice. If you're looking for books for more information on this topic, I'll recommend a couple. Susan Cain's Quiet is very well referenced and very readable as well. And Marty Olsen Laney's book, The Introvert Advantage, has a short chapter on raising introverts, although it's not as well referenced, and like Susan Cain's, tends to rely on books about shy people when describing how to raise an introvert. But if you're pretty sure your child is introverted and you'd like to learn more, I'd say both are worth a read. So, on to the tips. There are 7 of them. Firstly, introverted children may be more susceptible to the quality of care by parents and also by daycares and schools. This was dubbed the ORCID hypothesis by an article in The Atlantic, drawing on research by Jay Belsky and his colleagues at the University of California, Davis. The idea is that children who were perceived as difficult infants are more likely to be positively affected by high-quality parenting and childcare, and more likely to be negatively affected by low-quality parenting and childcare. The environment seems to have a larger impact on these children than it does on most others. High-quality parenting was determined to be a maternal sensitivity to child non-distress, lack of intrusiveness, positive regard, supportive presence, lack of hostility, and respect for autonomy. Supportive childcare was determined by a researcher who observed interactions between the caregiver and the child. So this is not to say that you need any really special skills to be a good parent to an introverted child, but if you can be generally supportive of your child and put him in a childcare situation where he's able to develop a good relationship with a teacher, then there's a good chance he's going to thrive. And if those things don't happen, there's a good chance he'll do rather less well. The second tip, as a parent, try not to project your own fears onto your child. Just because I hated lunchtime at school because everyone went off into their cliques and I didn't have anywhere to go doesn't mean the same thing's going to happen to my child. Maybe she kicks a ball around by herself at lunchtime because she wants to, and then she enjoys a bit of time being alone. So talk with your child and make sure you understand what's going on in her mind before you assume it's her painful shyness that's preventing her from socializing. Number three is to try not to let your own limitations become limitations for your child. The awful thing about playdates for introverted parents is that you end up having to socialize with the parents of the other child during the playdate. Rather than having a playdate with a different child every week, perhaps you could see if you have anything in common with the children that your son or daughter really seem to like to spend time with, so you can potentially get beyond the small talk and actually develop meaningful relationships with the parents. A fellow parent who lives just up the street from me said hi to me when we were out and about a couple times, and then she asked for my email address so we could keep in touch. And I tried to be tactfully cool in my responses because I figured we probably didn't have much in common other than the fact that we both have kids and live on the same street. And I really didn't want to have to be mommy friends with somebody. But she persisted, and it turns out that we actually have a lot in common. And now we have a casual dinner at one or other of our houses every couple of weeks, and we're totally easy with each other. Nobody dresses up, nobody tidies up, and we all just say what we think. And that friendship turned out to be the complete opposite of what I thought it would be, and I'm grateful that I have it. Number four, introverted people tend to take longer to form opinions and express ideas, which can make people think they're not very smart. One set of researchers asked students to assess their own ability to respond to new ideas quickly and say what's on their minds, and then rate how intelligent, engaged, and competent their classmates were. The students rated the people who could respond quickly as more intelligent, engaged, and competent early in the semester. But later in the semester, the ratings partly reversed, firstly because the intelligent introverts became more comfortable and started to speak up in class, and secondly because the unintelligent extroverts were discovered to have exuberance that exceeds their insightfulness, as the researchers put it. So where introverts have a one-shot chance to make an impact, like a job interview maybe a few years down the road, it's worth trying to put up a front and at least appear to be extroverted. But in the long haul, don't worry so much. If you're smart, people will eventually realize it, whether you speak up a lot or not. Introverts may find their communities in different places than extroverts. One study found that introverted people feel like they can be the real me by meeting people online or in other remote ways, kind of like I do through this podcast, whereas extroverts locate their real me through traditional social interaction. If your child's old enough to be online and finds or creates his own community, then don't worry as much if he doesn't have a big group of real-life friends as well. Number six. Provide opportunities for your child to socialize in traditional settings and set things up for them to be successful, but don't push it too hard. So if your child's invited to a birthday party, then maybe you can go at the beginning before too many other people get there, which can be much less overwhelming than entering a room that's packed with people. The general principle of trying to overcome fears in this way calls for the exposure to the social situation to be gradual, repeated, and prolonged. So try a small birthday party before a wedding with 100 attendees. And even if the party isn't successful from your perspective and your child still shows shy behaviors, keep trying. Don't throw in the towel. Prolonged exposure means you have to do the activity until your child's anxiety level drops, which it will. It's the way our body chemistry works. So if you walk into a party and your child is terrified because you got there late and there are lots of people already there, stick it out until her anxiety level drops. She might need to bury her head in your shoulder for a little while, but the idea is that eventually, her anxiety level will drop and she'll realize that the situation can be handled. And then in the future, the anxiety shouldn't be as bad and it should come down faster. And finally, at number seven, don't forget that there is nothing inherently wrong with being introverted or even shy. It's only troubling to the extent that it prevents you from doing the things that you want to do within your cultural context. Introverts struggle in America because we're essentially the most extroverted culture in the world. I found a fascinating diagram in a research paper where countries fall on a scale of introversion and extroversion. There is no more extroverted nation than the United States, even though there are quite a lot of introverts here too. But plop an American extrovert down in Uganda or Indonesia, and he might struggle in these most introverted of countries. I guess if I decide I really want to fit in somewhere, I could just move to Uganda. I always did prefer mountains to beaches anyway. Thanks so much for listening. You can find all the references to today's episode on yourparentingmojo.com/introverted. And as we talked about earlier, please don't forget to subscribe to the show and leave me a rating and a review. Send it out to your friends who you think might find it useful. And drop me a line with any special episode requests. Thanks. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift. 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.